À conversa no cais.
Esta semana fomos até Brixham, em Inglaterra, e falamos de papéis diferentes. De viver a 100 metros da praia e do campo de rugby. Da mãe, de um barco de 250 euros. Da vela offshore, de ser quase jornalista, do François Gabart, de grandes personagens, das quatro competições sagradas, do romantismo na vela, da Rolex Sydney Hobart, da revolta no Bounty, de sermos abençoados, de olhar pelos olhos deles, da vela ser como a dança, das crianças precisarem de saber onde estão, do Charles Darwin, de contar uma história enorme, do capitão Fitzroy e do Beaufort, dos Açores e do Pico, de usar uma extraordinária história para contar outra, e de ter visto nos Açores algo que não viu na Europa muitas vezes. O nosso convidado esta semana é o Conrad Humphreys. Bem-vindos à Conversa no Cais, o podcast do LX Sailing. Hoje vamos até a Inglaterra falar com o bom amigo Conrad Humphreys. Conrad, thanks so much for the time. It's a pleasure to talk with you here on our podcast. And first of all, I have a big doubt. How can we introduce you as a professional sailor, multiple speaker, adventurer, passionate about the world? How can you describe yourself?
I've been struggling with this question for many years, as you might expect. Do I call myself an entrepreneur? Do I call myself a professional sailor? I really don't know. I think my life has been a series of projects. I was a professional sailor for about a quarter of my life, and and now I'm involved in lots of different things, but mostly around the water, around the climate, around sustainability, and having fun.
And so you can have different roles in different chapters of your life. In what chapter are you now?
I think probably the chapter I'm in now is building things, telling stories. So, you know, I love, in fact, all through my life, there's a common narrative, and that is I'm a storyteller. And right now I'm trying to tell stories to help people to connect with our planet, with our oceans, with our environment, but using sport as that medium.
But let's go on the beginning of everything. You are born in Devon, and what's your first memory about the sea and everything? Because you had been a good rugby or a competitive rugby player on your youth. Where all start your relation with the sea?
Well, I guess I lived about 100 meters from the sea and from the rugby field. And if I turned left,
you are almost a Kiwi.
I exactly that. If I turned left, I ended up at the sailing club. And if I turned right, I ended up at the rugby club. And luckily, I had a mum that adored lying under the sun on the beach. And so I found myself more often than not in the summertime at the sailing club. And in the winter, I played rugby.
You told me that your mother had been... in reality, we both talk about our mothers and how they are important in our lives. But you told me that your mother had been very important on your starting of your sailing career or sailing or your beginning or your beginner, even or being a beginner on sailing.
Yes, yeah, very, very much so. I mean, so I was the youngest of four children. My father left when I was 4 years old, and in fact played no real part in my life for probably the first 15 or so years of my life. And my mum, you know, she didn't have very much. She was a nurse. She used to work as a nurse in the nighttime. She'd work during the day in the market, local market. And she, I think she saw something in me. And when I started sailing, she just knew that she would do everything possible to give me a boat, to find the money to get a boat. And which we did. We bought a little cadet for 250 euros equivalent. And this little cadet, I was a 9 year old. I remember pushing this cadet into my shed or garage in the street, and sanding it and painting it, and then pushing it out at the beginning of the season. So proud. And I think she saw in me someone who, you know, was really prepared to go to the extra, you know, the extra dimension. And we didn't have a car. So, you know, some years later, she was donated a car. And that was the first time she could take me to the other events around the country. But up until that point, before we had a car, I used to sail from Exmouth, where I lived, to Topsham or to Torquay, sometimes do an offshore in a little 10-foot dinghy before I did the championship. And I think, yeah, she was incredibly special, had a huge sense of belief. And that, at times, whenever I've doubted my own belief, she's always reminded me that, you know, I can do it.
You can do it. Yeah, that's right. And she was so right that you won a junior world championship in cadet, and you finished sixth on a cadet world championship, and then very young you moved to the Fastnet in 91. I was, in reality, offshore sailing was already in your mindset, in your blood and veins. So how it was?
Well, it, there are a lot of sort of coincidences. I mean, the first one I was just saying there about, you know, sailing offshore in my cadet to get to the next open meeting. But also, I grew up next to a very famous English boat builder called Peter Rousell, Spud Rousell, and together with another incredible yacht designer, Phil Morrison, they formed Rousell and Morrison, and they used to build our cadets, but they also built a lot of trimarans, a boat called Exmouth Challenge, which was quite famous in its time. And what I didn't realize was they built a boat called Enith, which was an Imoca 60. And I can remember at the end of a school day, arriving at the yard to sweep the sawdust off the yard. And Spud said to me, "Oh, we need you to help sand this big boat we're building in the hangar." And I was on the end of a longboard going up and down with this. And this boat was an Imoca 60. Now, I was 10 years old. I had no idea that, you know, 15 years later, I would be embarking on a campaign with, you know, to do the race called the Vendée Globe. You asked the question, how do I go from cadet to the Fastnet race? Gosh. Well, I was at the Junior World Championships in the cadets when I was asked by one of the teams of a Whitbread round the world race to join their youth team called the Youth Challenge. And for 3 years, we campaigned. We won the Fastnet in 1991. We won overall, and then we won the Round Britain race. And at the age of 19, I got the opportunity to sail around the world with a Ukrainian team in the Whitbread around the world race in 93-94. And so I literally went from sailing cadets to racing around the world.
And it's funny because at the beginning in our chat, you said you are definitely a great storyteller. And somewhere in the part of history, you were almost being a journalist also.
Yeah, well, I interestingly, when I came back after the Whitbread in 93-94, and I had intended to study journalism at Brighton University. And in fact, I even enrolled on a journalism degree course. But I realized when I got back from the Whitbread that I wanted to continue sailing at a professional level. And so I ended up going to Plymouth University and studying ocean science, oceanography and meteorology. And then from there, really pursued a professional sailing career.
But somehow that journalism, let's say, seed inside you keep until our days growing and growing, and your storyteller, your part of you, they're a great storyteller and love to share histories and so many things, and it's still inside you. It's a mix between at the time a professional sailor, an adventurer, entrepreneur, and the storyteller as some link with journalism, not in journalism to write for a media, but journalism you are a content generator at the end.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one thing I would say is that when you're embarking on a career as a professional sailor, there aren't many sponsorship agencies, there aren't and many communication agencies that look after sailors, at least there weren't back then. And you'll know this, you know, which because of the business you're in as well. And so you have to learn these skills. And if I was going to stand up in front of a sponsor, Motorola, and ask them for, you know, 3-4 million euros or pounds, I knew I had to be very convincing storyteller. I knew that I would have to paint a picture of what I could do in a very, very short space of time. And during those races, in particular during the Vendée Globe, I really enjoyed making content. I filmed 12 and a half hours of footage during the Vendée Globe, which enabled us to make a documentary, in fact, two documentaries about the race. I realized that actually, particularly when you're sailing on your own, talking to the camera or talking to something or somebody else is almost cathartic. It makes you feel good. And I love listening to people tell great stories. And in fact, the way I use a camera now is I try and almost treat it as another person. It's a mechanical device, but you're looking at this camera as if it's another person. You're telling it your story. And that's how I've always imagined storytelling, or the great storytellers do it well.
In reality, it's funny because nowadays, everybody are looking to have a onboard camera reporter to share stories and so on and so, and give some training to that people. And 20 years ago, you already have done that.
Yeah, I've always been really, really interested in it. And in fact, you know, if people ask me, you know, what have been the two most important things you've learned in your, you know, professional sailing campaign? And, you know, it's a bit of a cliche to say to get to the start of these races is the big challenge. You know, actually the sailing is the easy bit. But I've always felt that it's my ability to, you know, to persuade someone. I guess, you know, you could say I'm a very good salesman, and some people think selling or salesman are, you know, is a negative thing. But, you know, the best salespeople tell stories, and they tell stories that just bring you in, and eventually you want what they have. And I think, you know, that skill is something that I've really had to learn over the years. Because selling the Vendée Globe to an American company that can't even pronounce Vendée Globe,
was probably one of the most
difficult stories I was ever going to tell. But you know, I achieved it, and you know, it's now ever more. You know, anyone who's doing well in the sailing world are great storytellers, and I look at Imoca, I look at the Imoca class, and irrespective of who's going to win the race, I look at the ones that will be successful, and they are the great storytellers. And, you know, Francois Gabart, when he won the Vendée Globe, I mean, that was some of the most exceptional storytelling of a generation. Here was a young guy sailing absolutely out of his skin, but he also took his audience with him. And I remember that Vendée Globe being an incredible special one because, you know, we met Francois Gabart, the storyteller, as well as the sailor.
Yeah, it's true. Now, looking a little bit with a different angle, what are the main differences between the wheat bread races you have made and the ocean races we have nowadays? You have been linked to this last edition with doing commentaries and so you have knowledge to answer this question. What are the main differences?
I think the big difference, and I'm not ashamed to say this, is that, you know, back in the sort of, I guess, the early 90s when I did the Whitbread, it was still had that adventurous side. It had big characters. It had great storytellers. It had people like Laurie Smith and Grant Dalton and Dennis Connor and you know, these big characters who weren't scared of saying what they felt. And if I sort of fast forward now to the new sort of generation of sailors, you don't tend to see those big characters. They're protected by the machine, the communications machine. So if you think of 11th hour in the last race, you know, they can't be or say what they want because there's a big organization, you know, preventing that or being the gatekeeper. I think, you know, the women's team in the Whitbread had a very similar thing, and it was organized and run very professionally. This is the SEA campaign. But again, the women didn't really have a voice in that race. And I think that's one big difference, and one which I really respect about races like the Vendée Globe, because I think it is the one race where we still see great storytellers out there.
That's my next question. Yes, about Vendée, difference on Vendée.
And I don't know if your audience follows this closely, but if you looked at Boris Herman and his campaign, right the way through that team, they have tried to be honest and to really tell the story, and I think it really comes through. In my world, they are one of the great teams and will be a team that everybody talks about, irrespective of whether they win or not.
It's fun. But you think the Vendée Globe still is the, let's say, the holy grail of offshore sailing?
Well, I think there's four holy grails. There are the Olympic Games and the America's Cup, and then there's the ocean race and the Vendée Globe in terms of offshore sailing. And I would say those are the four holy grails. Yes, you know, there's new generation SailGP, there's, you know, lots of other things in that mix, but historically, the America's Cup, the Olympic Games, the ocean race and the Vendée Globe were the four pinnacles.
And why? Because I think they make us dream, we smile when we talk about that. It's because it's so hard to be there. Why?
I think like every sport or every adventure, you need the biggest mountains to climb, and they all have their uniqueness. You know, the ocean race was historically a team event, sailing high performance, very technical boats around the world at incredible speeds, but also a human endurance and human story. And I think you asked, you know, what's different now. you know, I think it's lost some of that character. I think it's less about the technology and the boats. It's less about even the human stories. It's become much more about sustainability and things which historically have always been there, but perhaps shouldn't or are not the lead story. In my mind, the lead story is that it's a technical challenge for teams to race as fast as they can around the world, and that's its DNA.
Do you think it's less romantic? Because romantic, from my point of view, is like is the way you can create heroes. You can create outstanding characters stay for life. It's, at that time, it's like Discovery's age. We can talk about Magellan, Drake, so many guys, because they are iconics. They are romantic heroes. They achieve doing something unthinkable. And nowadays, it's much more supported with background. We don't allow these persons, these characters to come up.
I agree with you. I mean, I think there are many facets to good storytelling. And, you know, some people get very excited by the technology of the America's Cup. Other people get more interested about the infighting and the drama between the America's Cup teams. You know, one of the things that's probably lacking from Sail GP is that drama between the teams. They all seem to, you know, like each other very much and get on very well. And of course, sometimes we're looking for that dip point of difference, you know, that you might see in other sports. I think, you know, we have to sort of look at what we do alongside all the other sports and activities that are fighting for individual attention. There is a big audience out there that still really enjoys the romantic side, the historical nature, and yes, probably most mainstream sports are chasing younger audiences, but actually there's a very big audience that they are probably starting to turn off. And, you know, by chasing the youth, chasing the sort of this new audience, you're competing across so many different spaces, and sailing is just one of them. But actually there is an audience that are being turned away from sailing that historically would love all of it. You know, love the historical side, love the technical challenge, love the adventurous side. And I think there is space for both.
But we need to talk about another race that you have made so many times for many, many sailors around the world. It's maybe the fifth leg on this Holy Grail, is the Rolex Sydney Hobart race. You were tried and you were almost close to win. What's so special about Sydney Hobart that it's on the bucket list of every sailor?
Wow. Without doubt. It's
all ever seen.
Yeah. I mean, it's one race that has pulled me back and back year after year after year. And, it's a short race. It's a 600-mile race,
yeah.
But it has everything in there. You know, it has strong currents. It has, you know, sometimes two different weather systems or weather patterns to navigate. It's long enough that you need to have some endurance. You need to pace yourself, but it's a sprint in some ways. So you can, you know, hang in there for two to three days. It's just a brilliant race. You've got the whole drama of the start and going out through the Sydney Heads and getting away from the coast. In some years that I've done that race, we've had water spouts, we've had little mini tornadoes, we've had extreme weather fronts. And then, of course, you know, you get across the Bass Strait, the shallow, confused difficult, sometimes treacherous waters of the Bass Strait, and then up into Hobart itself, which is another race. It's sometimes the wind shuts down and you're left there against the current. So it's very, very exciting. And I've come close to winning it in a Volvo 70 with Matt Allen navigating. Yeah. Unfortunately, we broke our rudder just about 30 miles from the finish line. But yeah, it's a magical race.
You still waiting for the phone call for Sydney Harbour?
Well, I haven't been for a few editions, which is sometimes a little bit sad. It's the one race I do try and give myself some time for, but. Yeah, equally, you know, I have other things going on, and so sometimes it's difficult to go away when you've got a young family, as I have had.
Yeah, it's Christmas. Yeah,
it's Christmas. You know, when they were very small, I could take them with me, but now, you know, if we all fly, it can be quite expensive to go and do that. Spend that time away, but. I'll always pick up the phone if someone's listening and needs a navigator for the Sydney Hobart.
You'll be ready. It's funny because we every time I talk with different kind of sailors, different backgrounds, when we discuss this race, that race, and then Sydney Hobart is always on the top of bucket list. So.
Yeah, I guess I've been really blessed with having a very, very varied sailing career. I don't know if it's the most varied, but you know, I've sailed certainly some very slow boats and some very fast boats. You know, I've owned Imoca 60s and Extreme 40s at the same time. I've sailed in the Archipelago Raid, which is probably one of the greatest Formula 18. Endurance races, and you know, came quite close to winning the Archipelago Raid in 1 year. So I love the variety, and I think that's one of the lovely things about professional sailing or about sailing in general. It has so much variety. I actually get as much pleasure now sailing at 5 knots as I did at 25 knots.
And let's say your professional sailing career is on, let's say, in standby mode or resting a little bit, you change completely to this Mutiny, Captain Blythe, epic voyage. How all of this start?
Well, I was approached first of all by a television company. They weren't really that clear what they wanted to do, but they said, we're looking for someone who can help us prepare a program. We want to retell a historical story, and your name has come up. We've spoken to quite a few different people and everyone has said, you know, you're the person to speak to. And I was quite curious as to who would put me up for a historical challenge. And then I learned that it was to retell the story of Captain Bligh in the infamous Mutiny on the Bounty, and that the television company actually wanted to build a replica of the boat to see if a group of people could endure that same ordeal as Captain Bligh and survive 4,000 miles in a tiny open boat. And I'm always open to new ideas. I think that's probably why, you know, I've had such a different, varied sailing career, because I find it very difficult to say no to things. And this was one of those that once I got involved and hooked, I wanted to be on that boat. I wanted to build that boat. I wanted to see that boat sail across the Pacific. And I did, you know, that was a very big television budget, £5.5 million Channel 4 budget, to create this tiny little boat and set sail. And I loved every moment of that voyage, and sat at the finish on the beach in Timor, having sailed from Tonga all the way to Timor. I looked at that little boat and I said to myself, I'm going to buy that boat from the production company. And I did. You know, 6 months later, that boat was back in the UK, and we were about to launch a new education program using that boat. And it comes back to what we were saying right at the beginning of this, is about a story. The story was very interesting, but actually what was more interesting was that this boat could tell lots of stories. If I bought it and I turned it into something, a storytelling tool, then I would be able to, you know, continually tell stories. And that I think is the one thing I would say in sailing that is a wonderful thing. You know, we think of the Magellan story, we think of the Shackleton story, we think of the Bligh story, we think of Francois Gabart's story, or Ellen MacArthur's story, or Pip Hare's story. We are blessed with these incredible stories, and they are fantastic tools for explaining life to young people.
And why so difficult in our days to bring kids to sailing? Because we have so many sports growing like hell, and we on sailing are always fighting to bring kids and keep kids on sailing. I have a theory about that. It's maybe because we want, instead of being for pleasure, we always put kids on competition instead of first. I always compare, when you're someone teach you to ride a bike, you don't going to be a professional cyclist. But when you put a kid on a opti or on a dinghy to start, you must go on competition. I think that's one of the biggest mistakes we are doing, because at the end, you can sail for pleasure all of your life.
Yeah, I agree. So I have a theory on this, and that is, and my theory is that when as parents, we're not looking at this sport through the eyes of our children. We're looking at it through our own eyes.
Yeah.
And that's a big danger, because our own eyes see, you know, this incredible sport that teaches you all these different skills, and, you know, whether it's racing or sailing for pleasure, it's, you know, but the person, the young person who sat there looking, is not seeing the same thing. And you're absolutely right. You know, what they're seeing is what can I be doing that's fun today? Because actually, you know, school is difficult, school is boring, you know, I've got to go and do my homework. But what can I do that is fun today? And then they have a choice. You know, some might choose to go sailing, others might choose to go to the shops, or some might choose to spend all their time on their mobile phones. And unless we make it fun, I think, you know, we'll continue to lose young people's interest. I have two daughters. They love sailing, but they don't choose sailing as their number one thing. I would love them to choose sailing as the number one thing, because that is what I want to happen, but it's not what they want to do. And I think that's the key here, really, is we have to start looking at it through their eyes, not through our own eyes.
Yeah. And after during the Captain Blythe epic voyage, you start a project in Plymouth. We related to exactly what we're talking about. Kids discovered the sea and sailing environment. Can you share us a little bit about that project? I know it's so important for you.
Yeah. So when the bounty boat came back to Plymouth, we launched the bounty project, and our focal point, our focus initially was on young people who would perhaps not ordinarily get an opportunity to get on the water. Certainly, you know, a lot of these kids don't go to the beach, don't go to the seaside, even though a lot of them live, you know, sometimes, you know, just a few miles away from the coast. But what I wanted specifically to do with the bounty boat is to create an environment where, you know, it was fun. It was easy. It was fun. It was no pressure to race or to, you know, to even learn specific skills. It was just, you know, come and have some fun on the boat. And, you know, I mean, I've talked quite a bit about this in the past. You know, a lot of children who are, you know, perhaps on the, what we say, on the spectrum, or the children who perhaps, you know, come from poor communities, they're not often in trouble, but, you know, they're perceived as being, you know, in trouble. They fidget, they can't sit still, they're told repeatedly, you know, don't do that, don't do this, and they rebel.
Yep.
And sadly now some of these children are given medication to sort of, you know, try and reduce their anxiety and in my mind, these are exactly the sort of young people that we should get on the water to go sailing. You know, sailing is like dancing. It involves movement. You know, you don't have to sit still when you're on a boat. You've got to constantly move. That suits those individuals. It's a sport that requires interaction with other people. You know, a lot of these young people find it very difficult socially to engage. But actually, put them on a boat together, very quickly they realize they can't work alone. They have to work together. And so what we've done with this particular project is develop, you know, a way of getting young people to interact with each other. There's more to it than just that, but in essence, that's what we do.
Yeah. In reality, you created a sort of a community center around the boat and about a container in the dock. It's really amazing.
Yeah, and it's growing, and I think, you know, to bring it back to the full, you know, full story, is that, you know, this is a wonderful story about human endeavor and about exploration and about discovering place and finding, you know, where we are in the world, who we want to be in the world. And I think, you know, young people need those stories. They need, you know, yes, they need to learn how to read and write, and they need to, you know, understand, you know, maths and science and various other things. But they also need to know where they are in the world, what can they bring, what skills, life skills they can develop. And I think that's the story that I'm most wanting to tell. You know, there are some fantastic stories out there which really, you know, make young people's eyes light up when they realize that, you know, they did that. Really? Did they do that? I mean, you know, a few days ago, we were out in the Azores learning about the whaleboat story. And I can tell you, my eyes were on storks, because I was like, really? They did that? They sailed in these tiny little boats and out into the channel, you know, with all that huge sail area. I mean, it's an incredible story. And I think, you know, young people need to hear, want to hear these incredible stories.
They are eager to, And your next chapter is about Mr. Darwin. What it's incredible, because you are, let's say, so fortunate that you first you can be have an important role on the story of Captain Blythe and that outstanding travel around the Southern Oceans, and now you are on way to Darwin. And Darwin, if Captain Blythe is easy story to share, because almost everyone saw the movie, if he's 30 something or over, when we talk about Darwin, is like talking about Magellan. It's worldwide. Everybody knows about Darwin theory and so on. So, and what you want to bring to the world with that Darwin experience?
I think it's a,
or
it's
just put a spotlight on the an outstanding research that they have done a few decades ago.
Well, I think there's a time, you know, we're about to celebrate, you know, this the 200th anniversary of this story, but there's a really critical story that the world needs to hear, and it's not dissimilar in gravity from what Darwin did 200 years ago. You know, he changed people's mindsets. You know, those that believed God, you know, created the world, to realizing that actually, you know, science had an important role. And you know, 200 years later, we as human beings and as humanity are facing, you know, some very, very critical decisions. And we now need a story so powerful, so important to be told, that we don't, you know, make the mistakes, you know, that we seem to be heading for. And I think, you know, this is probably the greatest story that everyone in the world is aware of. But now's the opportunity to tell it in a slightly different way. And hopefully with a life-changing impact, really, or a change of impact and a change of direction.
And another funny thing, in reality, I just discovered with you, maybe stupid from my side, but in reality, all of us have this image in our, even we learn about Darwin, we always have a photo of an old man with a beard. But when he started the travel with Beagle, he was only 22. So he's like an astronaut. The young guys had moved to the moon. Darwin had moved to the south of South America and Galapagos, and changed the way we saw the moon. Like the astronauts, the first photo they send us from the moon, look, the Earth is so small, it's so blue, it's so perfect. So they have so many similarities.
There are, and I think that's again, you know, a really important analogy, because we look at this story of this old man who, you know, who got us to think about, you know, the world in a different way. But in reality, he was a young guy who had to persuade his father that he should go on this voyage. He was recommended by his tutor at Cambridge University, but he'd only just finished and graduated with his naturalist degree. And what Captain Fitzroy, the commander, captain of the Beagle, saw in this young guy was hope, was actually, you know, someone who map perhaps will tell a different story. So traditionally, they would have always chosen the surgeon or the doctor on board these boats to do these sorts of studies. But Fitzroy, who in my view is a hero of this story as well, a very, very incredible sailor. He invented the barometer. He was an amazing navigator and surveyor in his own.
An entrepreneur, because he put his own money on that project.
And also an entrepreneur as well, he did. But he took a chance with Darwin. And I think that's really one of the most important messages that we want to take forward in this next chapter, is that, you know, we've got to build a future for, you know, our young people. And so on this voyage, you know, it's really important that we hear their story and we tell their story, because Darwin was only 22. And we can't keep saying, you know, young people don't understand, and, you know, we need the old wise people to come up with the right decisions. I actually think that the young people are very familiar with what's needed, and the old people need to move away and get off the off the boat and let the young people persevere.
Sorry. When do you expect that we can start to have some highlights, some stories about that outstanding story?
Well, the first stage in this project is to design exactly what part of the story we're going to tell, and we have already focused on the tools of the story and the parts of the story that Fitzroy and Darwin, and in fact Beaufort, who was also on the boat, who designed the weather, the wind range system, so we're going to focus on those particular elements of the story, and we're going to build something, a storytelling tool that will travel around the world and help people relate to the past and the future.
Maybe after that you can retire yourself and just come to a source and have some fun. And it wasn't in my mindset, but we need to talk about what we had been in the source last week or 2 weeks ago, and I remember you put me some questions about what we will go there, why we go there, and I said maybe the most interesting thing is go to the forest, cut a tree to build a mast, and I think I convinced you to come with this completely insane idea. But when you look, when you now, after a few days in the search, what's your feeling about that community of guys, young people sailing in the old sailing boats and hunting boats, and now they are looking to take care of the whales and the old sea and the environment, looking for the, it's fascinating, isn't it?
I think, you know, it's what are they doing in the Azores is they've taken, you know, a difficult story to tell, in that, you know, actually for these young Azorians, their livelihood was hunting whales, and the whales, you know, would swim through the Azores, and so they would, you know, there would be a bountiful supply of marine mammals that they could hunt. And of course, in the 80s, when whaling was banned and stopped, they had to shut down this industry, which was, you know, difficult for these communities, which survived, very much hand to mouth on their what they got from the sea and from the ocean and what they produced on land. But they, what has struck me perhaps more than anything else was how they are using this remarkable story to tell another story, and to flick the story from one of necessity and need to one of future and hope. And I think it's a wonderful story. The boats are a part of that story, but so are the characters, so are the people, so are the young people that are learning how to sail these boats. And that's the real magic of that whole experience. I would say to anyone going to the Azores, go and find out about that experience. Go and see these boats in action. Go and learn to be with, I mean, the hospitality, the warmth, the friendship. I saw things in 3 or 4 days on the Azores that I haven't seen across a lot of Europe for years. And that is a community who are working together to come together to live life simply and effectively, without destroying things, without arguing and fighting over possessions. I mean, it was a story of humanity right there in the Azores on Pico. And I think I've come away from that thinking that, you know, we complicate life with way too many possessions and way too many things. And yet, what do we really need? We need maybe a little boat, maybe the love of our families, some good food, a little wine. Actually, nothing else really matters. Friends. And some friends, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's the perfect way to finish our chat. We'd be sending our deepest regards and say hello to our Pedro, Felipe, Anna, Didi, José, all of that friends. They are there, and they are really, really great, great, great people. And so, Humphrey, Conrad, thanks so much for your time. It was always a great pleasure to talk with you and share your dreams and share your passion, and especially the way you see. And I think the great pleasure for me is now I can see a little bit of my world through your eyes, and that is really amazing. So thanks so much for your time.
Thanks very much for inviting me to join you today, and also thank you so much for the invitation to the Azores, because you know, it's opened my eyes. I've seen and found some new friends that have really, really helped crystallize the next chapter in my life.
Okay, my friend, let's keep in touch, and until next chat and podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. Conrad, absolutely.
Bye, and thanks so much for your time, buddy. See you later.
See you soon.
E assim chegamos ao final de mais uma Conversa no Cais. Para a semana cá estaremos com novos convidados.